Addiction. It's a darkness that wraps itself around your entire being, tightening its grip on everything that means anything to its victim, the addicted. In a blink, it will take away all your hopes, your dreams, your everything. It chooses its victim without prejudice. It simply doesn't care if you're black or white, young or old, rich or poor. It welcomes all. So when family man and father of two, Christopher Dietrich's life hit on hard times, addiction was right there in the shadows waiting for him. And with it came people into Christopher's life that may have very well determined his fate. This is the case of Christopher Dietrich, and this is Gone in a Blink. Hey, true crime fans, I'm your host, Heather, and welcome to episode 15 of Gone in a Blink. Today's case is out of Elkton, Maryland, where 41-year-old Christopher Dietrich went missing shortly after surveillance footage captured him talking to two unknown people in a parking lot. After the interaction, they both parted ways, and Christopher hasn't been seen or heard from since. Christopher's sister, Sarah, has been on a tireless mission to find answers into the disappearance of her brother. Christopher Dietrich was born on December 16, 1977 in Delaware to parents Pamela and Jan Dietrich. Here's Sarah on what it was like growing up with Christopher.
Christopher, and just like myself and my mother, we are pranksters, jokesters. We'd rather laugh than be mad and things of that nature. My dad was always more serious than the three of us. We were a pretty close family, and then my parents divorced when I was 8, and I guess Christopher was around 10 or 11. He's not quite 3 years older than me, so he was probably 10 or 11 at the time. And that basically changed him as far as a lot of aspects of him and his life and how he was. But he still tried to remain being a jokester and a pretty respectful person. I mean, he was always so caring and helpful with everyone. We spent quite a few years living with my grandmother, me and my mom, and my brother. And my grandmother was a very wonderful person, never spoke ill of anyone in her life. And she kind of raised us with that same aspect, telling us, you know, to always be the bigger person, the better person, kill people with kindness, that kind of thing. And that's kind of been how me and my brother most of our lives have always been, is just try to be nice to each other and to other people and help if you can. And so, he was a pretty cool guy. He was very charismatic, like he could get anyone to be his friend. He would light up a room when he came into it. He was athletic, although when my parents split up, that kind of took him out of that realm of wanting to do any type of organized sports, as he would call it. He didn't mind playing, you know, kickball in the backyard with friends, that kind of stuff. But as far as like playing on a team, like he no longer was interested in that. He was a very smart person. We always joke that he was a knower of a lot of things, but a master of nothing. Like, I mean, he had so many friends, and like he would just throughout like teenage years, early adult, would, you know, work with one friend and do masonry. And then next thing you know, he's doing drywall with somebody. And then, you know, he's building decks and he's doing landscaping. Like, I mean, he could just do so many different things. And he got the knack for working on cars from my father. Now, he didn't exactly learn that from him. And that's the one thing out of anything my mom's ever said about my dad, she's the only good thing she ever said is, you know, don't really care for the man, but he is good at cars. He knows his thing about that. And I guess Chris got that from him. So he loved, you know, doing that, you know, basic stuff like brakes and, you know, that little stuff. But he could do all that kind of stuff. And he was just, you know, he was a hard worker when he was motivated. But then when he wasn't motivated, he could be very to himself. And like, as much as he liked being around people, he also liked to be alone. Like when my parents were still together, they had offered him a room in the basement, and he would have his own bathroom and everything. And oh my God, he was so excited about that. Like, oh my God, I have my own space. Like, you know, but yet he would want to like hang out at the same time. And then when we moved in with my stepfather, he again got offered the basement bedroom. Couldn't have been the better, you know, couldn't have been asked anything better, you know.
In early 2000, Christopher married the love of his life, Shiloh. Shiloh and Christopher knew each other back in high school, but it wasn't until many years later that they would begin dating and eventually marry. Soon after, Shiloh became pregnant and made Christopher a proud father of twins, a baby girl named Sarah and a baby boy named Michael. Christopher was on cloud nine, and sadly, Christopher and Shiloh's marriage didn't last, and the couple eventually divorced less than 10 years after they were married.
Tell me about his marriage to, was it Shiloh?
Yes, he was with Shiloh. I don't even know how many years that was. I want to say they started kind of talking 2000, maybe the end of it. They had met each other at a, I don't know if it was at a bar or a party. I'm not even really sure exactly where they met. I know they went to high school together and they graduated together, but this was obviously years after because they graduated in 95. And it was 5 months, well, 4 months maybe into the pregnancy, she found out she was having twins. So that was like a, oh, okay. It was a whoops, we're pregnant turned into, oh, okay, we're having a daughter and a son, which how perfect is that? You have one of each. You're good. So they got married in July of 2001, had the twins in October. They were together, I'm going to say till she, they were like two and a half. They kind of separated, then they got back together briefly, and then they separated again. And that was like their final separation on that. She was always great with him, seeing the kids and stuff like that. Like she was never, you know, trying to hold them over him. Even when he was, you know, doing his, I guess, homeless but not homeless person self, she would meet up with him, go like pick him up with the twins like at least once a month and take them all to dinner. And they'd go out and have dinner together, the four of them. You know, she always made sure to keep involved. I mean, me and Shiloh were his emergency contacts, if that tells you anything, even though they were separated. They literally only got divorced, I want to say the year he went missing, the beginning of that year maybe, only because she was going to be getting married. And that's really the only reason. They didn't really care about getting divorced. They were separated. And in Maryland, that was good. Like, you didn't have to be divorced, but she was going to be getting married, so she kind of then needed to.
Did he move out of the home or did she move out of the home?
He moved out. They were living in the basement of her father and stepmother's house. And they had their own little apartment down there, and like a refrigerator. They shared a kitchen and bathroom, but they had like a little living room and the kids' bedroom in there. So they lived in there. And then when he left her, he actually lived with me and my ex-husband. Me and my ex-husband split up. My brother stayed living with him, because they were super close. And then I talked him into getting a place with me and my daughter's father. Had her in 2011.
Christopher moved in with his sister, Sarah, after the divorce. He began working for a company who was opening a new branch in Ohio, and Christopher was asked to travel to the new location to help with the opening. While in Ohio, Christopher met a woman by the name of Nicole. The two became inseparable, and Christopher ended up bringing her back home with him to his sister's house in Elkton, Maryland. This is pretty much when Christopher's life began to spin out of control. According to Sarah, Nicole introduced her brother to the cruel and unforgiving drug world. Sarah did not want drugs in her house, and rightfully so. And because Sarah had children of her own, she was forced with the difficult decision to ask her brother to find a new place to live. Here's Sarah.
He met Nicole, which was his downward spiral.
So he meets Nicole. Where did he meet Nicole?
Well, he was doing awesome at his job, the best he had been doing at a job, like I think ever in his life. And he was at like one of the head supervisors, and they were opening another location. It was called MBM. I'm not sure what exactly that stands for, but they were a food distribution company. They were opening up a location in Ohio, and they offered to pay for him to go out there, open up the new location, all that stuff. But he had to be there for a month, and that they would pay, you know, for all his food, his hotel, all that stuff, his flight out there and all that. So he accepted because he was going to be getting paid good for it. Literally 2 days before he left Ohio, he met her at, I don't know if it was like a restaurant/bar, and he just was like, oh my God, girl's awesome. And he came home, and probably within a month, she came and stayed with us for about 6 months. I thought it was kind of odd. She had two children. One was around the age of the twins at the time, and the other one was four, kind of young. I was like, wow, why is she, you know, leaving her kids? He's like, what's the long story? And I'm like, well, I have time, because if a mom's willing to leave her children, just
right.
to come here, like, that something's not right there, you know, like, that's just, like, the only reason she went back is because she got him hooked on drugs, and they ended up both leaving and going back to Ohio, and they were both so bad out there that her family was like, you guys need to get away from each other, like, this is bad. So her uncle actually paid for Chris's bus ticket to come back from Ohio. He rode a bus back from Ohio to Delaware, where my dad picked him up. Somebody had an overdose in the basement of our house that we were renting together when I was at work one day, and my daughter's father called me and was like, hey, ambulance are here, someone overdosed, your brother revived her, they came, got her, whatever. I was like, okay, we're done with that. So I was like, you can't be here anymore. I'm not trying to have the state come take my kid from me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, we didn't speak for a little bit with that because, you know, I was very upset with him. We eventually did talk after that, but and we mended everything with all that, especially when he came back. He was with my dad for a little bit. And then my dad ended up losing his place, and him, my dad, my brother, my dad's wife, and her daughter ended up coming up to Elkton. They were living in their car. Dad got a job. They were kind of doing a little bit better, I guess. You know, they were all up here, and he was closer to us, so we could see him more and stuff. And then Donna swore, that's my dad's wife, that my brother was stealing from them. My brother never really did that kind of stuff. That's not his thing, and I don't think he would have done that to them. But Chris got very angry with him. He's like, I'm done with you guys. I'm not staying with you. So that's when he went and was just sleeping in the woods, and me and Shiloh got wave of that. So we ended up doing what we needed to get him a tent, because with the history that he had, you know, in Ohio and stuff, we were, you know, I was not trusting him to be around my child. Not that he would do anything to my child, but just I didn't want any drugs around her.
Absolutely.
And I didn't believe he was good with that, because it's a hard drug to come away from. It's not something you're done with, you know. But I always, you know, I told him, I said, I will support you every way I can. But, you know, we were living with my boyfriend's mother and grandfather. So he couldn't come stay with us anyway. And I may have, especially when it got cold, just because it's my brother. I just would have been watching him like a hawk and, you know, whatever. But it wasn't my place where I was living, so I couldn't do it. So I was like, well, I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that he stays warm, he has food, all that stuff. I had an extra phone line on my phone account, so I got him a phone, so that way we would be able to contact him, know where he was at all times. If he needed anything, you know, he could be able to have communication with his children, all that. And that's basically how it was the last, I don't know, I guess eight years maybe before he went missing.
Christopher and Nicole's relationship didn't last. After about 6 months, they called it quits, and Christopher was homeless until he met a man by the name of Wes. Now, Wes lived with his parents, Bill and Sue, in Elkton. So, Wes was terminally ill and ended up passing away in 2016, but not before he made his parents promise to take care of Christopher after he was gone. Chris continued to live with Wes's parents. However, he didn't want to feel like a burden or anything like that, so he set up a tent in their backyard, and that's mainly where he would stay. Although he was told he could come and go as he pleased between the inside and outside of the home, so he pretty much lived in the backyard. Here's more from Sarah on that.
Where does Wes fit into all this?
This was, I guess, during this next tent situation when he started living in the tent in Meadow Park. I guess he met Wes at some point walking around. I mean, Elkton had a lot of homeless in their town limits. They would all kind of meander around, and, you know, the drug users and homeless would mingle together, and I guess he must have met him sometime through that period. They actually, Wes got him out of Meadow Park, and him and Wes ended up staying in a tent in what they called Tent City in Elkton. And it was like a little trailer park, but tent. They were all, like, set up. They had little paths. They had a little fire pit. And it was all stuff they had found people, like, dump on the side of the road or, like, throw out. Like, they had, like, this rickety shelving unit that had different types of bug sprays and citronella candles. And they had a little tarp put up, and they'd found, like, one of those hospital toilets. They had that, a broken mirror. So it was, like, a little makeshift, like, bathroom for them all to use. Like, a little community. But yeah, he stayed there for a little bit, and then someone got wave that Wes was gay, and there was an altercation, so they left there because they didn't feel safe sleeping there because, you know, they didn't accept Wes being gay, and I was Chris's buddy, so he didn't want to leave Wes. So Wes's parents, Wes and Chris, to come to their house. And Chris was like, I'm not staying inside. Wes did, but Chris didn't. That's when they put the tent up outside. That was like that for a few years. And then Wes, and he died. He had, I don't know if it was an aneurysm or what, like he just started bleeding from his rectum and in his stomach area and died in their house. And he knew he was dying because he was sick. He was an alcoholic at one point, so it had hurt his body a lot. And he had made his mom promise that she would always look after Chris, even when he wasn't around. So that's basically why Chris stayed there with them after Wes. I mean, I'm going to say Wes died in 2016. They wanted him to stay in the house, but he did not want to do that. He said they were like hoarders, and he was like, I'm no part of that. And they said, all right, fine, you know, you can put a tent in our backyard. They had electrical cord ran to it, so he had heat in the winter. He could charge his cell phone. Like, he came in to shower and eat there, and she did his laundry, like, but he just wanted to be by himself. Like, I don't know, as much as he liked being around people, he liked to be alone at the same time. And in 2015 is when Chris got diagnosed with melanoma. So Wes, you know, was helping him with that as much as he could. And of course, it was great that he was at his, you know, Wes's parents, because he could shower and keep the area clean and stuff like that. And he would take medical transportation from the Cecil County Health Department's University of Maryland to have immunotherapy treatments, because that was really all they could do. Mm-hmm. I think melanoma, you can't do radiation or chemo, like, so they usually do an immunotherapy type thing. Shiloh and myself both offered to take him and go with him. And, you know, we were like, you can't fight this alone. He said, no, I'm fine. I'll just take my, you know, I'll take the thing. I got it. I don't want to burden you guys. We're like, you're not a burden. Like, we want to be there for you. He wouldn't allow us to do it. He would just say, you know, I'll let you know when I'm going. You know, I'll call you before I leave, call you when I get back, and that kind of stuff. So we were not allowed to be part of that. That always kind of bothered me that he wouldn't let me be part of his treatments. But, he had those treatments, and basically he had a limp from that. And if he walked for too long, like he said 10, 15 minutes max, he would get this god-awful swelling. Like, he couldn't even walk when that would happen.
In 2019, Christopher was diagnosed with melanoma in his leg, which actually caused him to walk with a limp, and a pretty noticeable limp at that. His health began to slowly decline, and he was eventually hospitalized. Here's more from Sarah.
He had gone into Union Hospital, which is now Christiana Care in Elkton. He was having these chest pains, all this stuff. They had him in there for a couple days. He ended up getting really bad, delusional. He ended up contracting MRSA in there and was flown to University of Maryland. And it was at that point that I found out that I was his emergency contact. He never told me that, like, ever until this point. And University of Maryland called and was like, hey, you know, we need to know, does he have a DNR? And I was like, I don't know. I'm like, we've never talked about that, so I would say no, he doesn't. You know, like I'm not making that call, even if he had it. I'm not that person. So he spent quite a few weeks in there. University of Maryland was all about helping him until they found out that he had no insurance and a history of drug use. And man, did they try everything they could to get him out of that induced coma and get him out of their hospital.
Wow.
Like, it was crazy. It was crazy how much they were doing for him. And then suddenly it was like, nope, we're good. So he was intubated for a very long time in there, a couple weeks, to the point that when he did come out of it, he had to go to a rehabilitation center to learn how to walk again.
When he was in the hospital, what was it that put him in a coma?
He had contracted MRSA at Union Hospital and had a horrible infection throughout his body. They said he had endocarditis. There was a lot of inflammation and infection in his heart. He actually, his left arm was like almost like elephantitis, really. It was like 3 to almost 4 times the size of the other arm, just filled up from infection, they said. And that could have very well been from his drug uses, shooting up in that same arm or whatever. That's what their assumption was, I guess. I don't know if that was ever determined, but they had to basically put him in an induced coma just to try to help his body fight.
Did they ever try to get him help for his drug use?
After he came out of that and was, you know, did the rehab thing for learning how to walk and all that all over again, I had talked him into going into a rehab facility. I took him all the way down to Baltimore somewhere. And I literally checked him in. He was supposed to be there for, I think it was 60 days. He contacted me 2 days and he's like, I can't do this. I got to go. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You're killing me. You got to do this. No, I can't. I can't. I can't. So I went and freaking got him because I couldn't keep him there. I mean, it was in, you know, it was a strictly voluntary basis. It wasn't like he was court ordered to go or anything like that. So they said, we can't keep him.
On the day of Chris's disappearance, he was captured on surveillance camera at 11:15 a.m. in the parking lot of the Help Center located in Elkton, where he was going to get an external battery for his cell phone. He is seen talking with two individuals, one male and one female. Sarah told me that the two other individuals in the footage are Daryl Porter and Jara Griffith. Both have told authorities that they spoke briefly to Christopher before parting ways with him. According to Sarah, after the encounter with Daryl and Jara, Chris was supposedly heading to the home of a man by the name of Sterling Tillman, who Christopher had sold some prescription pills to and then decided that he needed them back. Christopher never made it to Sterling's house that day, and it's important to note that according to Sarah, Sterling refuses to speak with police.
So, okay, so there is surveillance of your brother. It was the last images, the last sighting of him. And he is seen with two individuals, a mm-hmm. female and a male. Mm-hmm. Do you know who these people are?
Yes, that is Daryl Porter and Jara Griffith. I'm not sure at what point they met up, but supposedly, according to Daryl, they met up on Chris's way there. They just happened to be in town, and they walked over with him, is what he tells me, and waited for him to go inside. What the health department said, and Daryl said, that Chris was going to the health department to pick up his external battery for his cell phone, because that was like his lifeline. He had taken transportation to University of Maryland on the 28th. He left it in one of their transportation vehicles, so he was going there to retrieve it. He got the external battery, and then that's when they left. And supposedly, they walked in front of the police station over to the Help Center parking lot. And that's where, I guess, I don't know at what point, whether it was on their walk or at that Help Center parking lot, that Chris had said that he was going to go see Sterling Tillman. Something about he had sold him some of his prescriptions and he needed, you know, he wanted to see if he could get them back. At least that's what they said. They said he went towards Sterling's house, which is two houses down from this parking lot that's right across the street from the police station. They said he walked that way, they went the other way, and then that was the last known footage. Now, the police said their cameras couldn't pick up the sidewalk that's connected to their parking lot. And the Help Center, which is a place where a lot of people will go to get help paying their electric bills, their rent. Sometimes they would have like breads and little types of food like that. They supposedly didn't have any surveillance. There's a lot of the courthouses are all around there. With the heavily involvement of homeless and drug addicts in the town of Elkton, you can't tell me none of those people have cameras. Those security footages probably only last for so long. And since I didn't file the report till June 7th, it was probably not on their cameras any longer.
So he was heading to Sterling Tillman's house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you said he was going to try and get some pills back?
Yeah, he had sold him prescription drugs. This is what Daryl and them said. Now, I don't know. Like I said, I don't know how true this is or not, but that's what Daryl had said that Chris was doing. I did contact Sterling. I got his phone number from someone, and I called him. Soon as I found out that was a thing. And he had said that he saw Chris the day before he went missing and that he fed him breakfast, but he didn't see him the day of.
So he never made it to Sterling's house that day?
According to Sterling, I don't know. That could be a lie. The police would not talk to Sterling. The original detective on the case, which is Detective Comley, she said that Sterling doesn't talk to police, that if I could get a recording of him saying that, you know, he saw him or whatever, that they could then use that, but that she wasn't going to try to talk to him because he's a known drug guy in Elkton and he wouldn't talk to police.
So what happened to Christopher after he was seen on surveillance footage? Considering his poor state of health and the fact that he was walking with a very noticeable limp, he couldn't have made it that far. It seems that while Christopher had very positive people in his life, like Sarah and Shiloh and his children and many other family members, he was also surrounded by some very shady people in his life that could have caused him harm. one of them being a so-called friend of Christopher's by the name of Wayne. Christopher had lived with Wayne at one point, and Wayne was extremely abusive towards Christopher. After Christopher's disappearance, there was word that Wayne was bragging about having possession of Chris's cell phone. Here's what Sarah had to say about Wayne.
When I had gone into Union to see him, there was this guy named Wayne Barnett, older man. And I'm like, who the heck is this guy? And everyone's like, hey, Sarah, this is Wayne. This is my buddy Wayne. This is my sister Sarah. And I'm like, so I'm there for a few minutes. Wayne's like, well, I'll go. I'll let you guys do your thing. And I'm like, who the heck is this man? Well, this is my buddy. And I'm like, okay, why is there like an older man interested in chilling with you? Like, I don't know. It's just weird to me. He's like, no, he's my friend. He's cool. He's cool. So I guess he contacted him and Wayne said he could come stay with him. Well, then that's when I started finding out about who exactly Wayne was. He was this older guy that would get drunk and abuse my brother if he didn't do sexual favors to him. So
wow.
There was numerous times that I had to pick up Chris because he had fled from Wayne. And I wanted him to file a police report. Oh, no, I can't do that. It's fine. He's drunk. He doesn't know what he's doing. I'm like, dude, like that's crazy. He's like, but he would never report any of that. And I honestly think Wayne knows exactly what happened to my brother. I think he's affiliated in some way. Just my opinion, just because of their history. So me and my mom in 2022 did an interview with Mark Roper for the Baltimore News. And when that aired and all that, Wayne's, I believe, nephew, his girlfriend or wife, I think wife, she reached out to me and said, hey, because I had talked to her because I knew she knew. I went on Chris's Facebook and was messaging people that I didn't think looked too shady or too scary. And she had said, you know, she really didn't know much, but she knew who Chris was. But when she saw that news report, she said it jarred her because they had mentioned about his cell phone. The police said they didn't know what kind of phone he had. She said that reminded her that there was a time within those last, like, first few months that Chris went missing that Wayne was talking to her husband, his name is Larry L.J. Alexander, and said that Wayne really missed Chris, but he was glad he had his cell phone.
Another person who Christopher had crossed paths with who could have played a potential part in his disappearance is a man by the name of Ricky Puckett. Now, Ricky was said to have been a drug runner for the motorcycle gang known as the Pagans. Sarah's boyfriend, Tim, had gone to school with Ricky and had known him for a really long time. Tim had introduced Christopher to Ricky, and Sarah learned later on that Chris had even gone with Ricky on some drug runs. Ricky has been named as a person of interest in Christopher's case. Here's more from Sarah.
So when they had called June 5th to say he didn't make it to his appointment, at first I was like, okay, you know, he had done that one other time. They had called, I'm going to say in the beginning of 2019, and said Chris didn't make it to his appointment. I was like, I'm going to get a hold of him. And I called him and said, hey, how come you didn't get in your treatment? And he was like, I did. He's like, well, I went to University of Maryland, but they had me at another location. I didn't go to my treatment. And so when June 5th happened and they said, you know, he didn't show up, I'm like, are you sure he didn't come there and just went to a different part of the hospital? No, we know that happened one other time. So we already looked into that before we called you. And let's see if I can get a hold of him, figure out what's going on and have him contact you. And I called and went straight to voicemail. I was like, So when that, you know, I tried calling everybody I could, and I had Tim, my daughter's father, call Ricky when I couldn't get Chris. And when he called Ricky, when he answered, he said, I had a feeling you'd be calling. And he said, what's that even mean? He's like, well, I got a tip from the Chester County Pagans that the Cecil County Pagans were looking for Chris. Ricky supposedly was like a drug runner for the Pagans. Now how true any of that is, I don't know. Yeah, and then sometimes Chris would go with him, supposedly. I don't know. Apparently there was a lot more meetings with Ricky and Chris that I never even knew about. Actually, Tim was even involved with that a couple of times. Ricky and Tim went down to see Chris, and apparently there was like a drug and gun deal that happened, and Tim just happened to be with them. But Chris was the person who got the connection for Ricky. Ricky had the gun, was supposed to be trading it for drugs, and Tim said they were surrounded and locked into this room with about five guys, and Tim said he thought he was going to die right then and there. And I said, well, you know, I don't even know, you know, I had no idea any of this was happening. I'm like, I was livid with Tim, but he spilled his complete beans to the cops about any information he knew between Ricky and Chris. Of course, when they found phone record, got the phone records, they found even more stuff that Tim didn't know about between Ricky and Chris. No, this was towards the last few months of his of him being around. So that's, and I was completely in the dark about even knowing any of that was going on. I was like, "Your God!" Like, I didn't think it was that level, you know? Like, I had no idea, and I was so mad at Tim for, like, I'm like, seriously, like, this was going on, and you didn't say anything to me.
And you said that Ricky is a person of interest currently.
Yes, yes. Actually, Ricky sold drugs to Tim's stepbrother that actually lethally killed him in March of 2020. Pennsylvania, because Ricky's from Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania State Police have evidence of this. Ricky fled the area. He's actually in Cecil County now, in Northeast, the town over from where Chris was last seen. And they know this, but they're not going to go after him, is what Pennsylvania is saying. They said if he comes into the United States, then we'll get him then. But if not, you know, they're not too worried about it. But that day, this is another weird situation with this whole thing that gives another person of interest. When I went to Bill and Sue's, his tent was still up in their backyard. And I said, hey, can I go back there and look? See if there's anything he left behind, anything. So they were like, no, no, our dogs are back there. Well, I had seen their dogs and had been in the yard with their dogs numerous times. I would go there once, sometimes twice a month on a regular basis, the whole time Chris lived there, to pick him up, to take him to lunch, go to the park with my daughter and him. Like, me and my daughter went there regularly to see him. That's where we would pick him up. No, mm-hmm. you can't. Well, not even a week later, well, I had called Sue and I said, you know, can we make a time for me to come look for Chris's stuff? Oh, well, I don't have it anymore. I'm like, you don't have it anymore? No, we got rid of it. And I'm like, where is it? Well, we threw it away. And I'm like, well, he had stuff. Oh, he didn't have much. So they were at a, you know, they felt strongly enough that he was not coming back to get rid of all his things. Now, what would give that impression?
How long was this after his disappearance?
So it was probably about 15 days. And mind you, Detective Comley never interviewed them, never went to that house. That was his last known address. That's where he slept. That's where he ate. That's where he bathed himself. That's where his mail went to. They never went there and searched it. Like, don't you search the last known address? And I had asked her, like, why aren't you looking there? Well, there was no known struggle. Yeah, they've never interviewed me, my mother, his ex-wife. His ex-wife had to call them and give a statement. I just now, at the end of March, had an interview with the third detective on Chris's case, only because he wanted to see what I knew.
Well, and do you think, and I've seen this in cases, unfortunately, where they will look at the victim, and not that this is right at all, because it's not, but they could chalk it up to, oh, he was a drug addict, you know,
yep.
He probably went and OD'd somewhere, and they don't
yep.
really investigate, and it's unfortunate, because it doesn't matter. I mean, he's a person. He's a human being. And I don't care what he was addicted to or what, you know, how bad his life got. He deserves to be looked for.
Yeah, they were trying at that point to get rid of the homeless in the town limits of Elkton. So I really feel, in their opinion, they were like, hey, one less homeless guy we got to worry about.
So where do you believe the case is standing today?
Unsolved and in my hands. They're saying, I mean, the most action it's probably had is right now. And that's my legwork and the fact that there's a new detective on the case.
So Detective Conley's no longer the detective on the case?
No,
so
she
was.
So
what is the new detective's name?
His name is Officer Blackson.
As of today, there has not been much progress in Christopher's case. Detective Comley was once the lead detective on the case and has since been replaced by Detective Blackson. Sarah continues to advocate for her brother and to search for answers into his disappearance. Christopher's children, Michael and Sarah, hold an annual gift drive for the homeless in honor of their father. If you have any information into the disappearance of Christopher Dietrich, please call the Elkton Police Department at area code 410-398-4200. Thank you for listening to another episode of Gone in a Blink. If you like our show, please consider giving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'd love for you to follow us on any of our social media sites. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And I will post those links on our show notes. And if you have an idea for a show, we would love to hear about it. You can email us at goneinablinkpod@gmail.com. And finally, please remember, stay safe, stay smart, and try not to blink.